the Caffeinated Thoughts Podcast. Hi, this is Shane Vanderhart. Welcome back to another episode. Today, I had a conversation with State Senator Marionette Miller-Meeks. She represents State Senate District 41, which encompasses Wapello County, which is Ottumwa, and I believe some of the area around Wapello County. I'm not looking at a map, so I'm not entirely sure. This is her fourth time running for Congress in Iowa's 2nd Congressional District. She has a contested primary. We spoke to her competitor a couple weeks ago, former Congressman Bobby Schilling. Miller-Meeks served in the military for 24 years as a private. She was also a nurse and a doctor, in particular an ophthalmologist. She went into private practice in Ottumwa in 1997, and she remains there with her husband, Kurt. She has two grown children, Jonathan and Taylor. And in 2010, former Governor Terry Branstad appointed her as the director of the Iowa Department of Public Health, where she served for 3 years. She was elected to the Iowa Senate in 2018. Before we get to that conversation, first a word from our sponsor, American Principles Project.
At American Principles Project, we believe that human dignity should be at the heart of public policy. We work in all 50 states and in Washington, D.C. to promote life, religious freedom, local control over education, authentic economic progress for working Americans, and a return to constitutional principles such as federalism. Want to help American Principles Project? Visit our website today, AmericanPrinciplesProject.org. That's AmericanPrinciples, P-L-E-S, Project.org. Sign up for email updates. Help us out. We want to work with you. That's AmericanPrinciplesProject.org.
Without further ado, here's my conversation with State Senator Marionette Miller-Meeks, Republican candidate in Iowa's 2nd Congressional District. Marionette, welcome to the Caffeinated Thoughts Podcast.
Well, thank you very much, Shane, and good morning to you.
Good morning. And so a question I ask every candidate, whether I'm talking to a presidential candidate or somebody running for state house or mayor, why do you want to run and run again? This is your fourth time, I believe, running for Congress.
It's my fourth time running for Congress, and I actually didn't think I would be running for Congress again. There are circumstances and things that happen that make you believe that if you're called to serve, that you need to step up to the plate. And so I had been asked in 2018 to run for the state Senate. And after prolonged responses of no, I wouldn't do it and find somebody else, I was persuaded by Governor Reynolds and people within Wapello County and the party to run for the state Senate so we could keep that seat in Republican hands, because I had helped Mark Shulgren get elected when I outperformed the ballot in our Wapello County area, which is also a Democrat district, very blue-collar union area. So between May and October of 2018, my husband and I door-knocked over 25,000 doors. And even though we had 3,000 more registered Democrats than Republicans in our district, we won by over 800 votes. And I was elected to the state Senate for a candidate that was very reluctant to do so, and for the reasons you've mentioned. But we did some very good health policy stuff in the state Senate. It was very stressful, but I felt that the result was that within the keeping of my philosophy of smaller government, reducing regulation, not increasing taxes, we actually got more access, less regulation that created burdens to physicians and nurse practitioners and physicians' assistants. So better access without increasing regulation or increasing cost. And we did some really good things. And so over this summer, and I had been initially asked during session about running with Loeb Sachs retirement. And I said at this time it was not something I was considering doing. But when I was back full-time with patients and people were talking to me about running for the seat, I'd got the Senate seat very successful and got invited to the White House by President Trump for signing of the healthcare pricing transparency executive order. And this was something that we had done and attempted to do in Iowa, the bill I ran looking at transparency and pricing for pharmacy benefit managers. So trying to get a handle on prescription drug costs, which is very high, and it's becoming a tremendous issue, especially for people on life-saving drugs like insulin. Mm-hmm. So the compendium of all of these things, and then watching the Democrat debates where, you know, every candidate raised their hand to do Medicare for all, to end private health insurance, to give, free health care to illegal aliens. All of these things kind of compounded upon itself to where I felt that I'm being called to serve, and this is, you know, what I'm meant to do. So although it wasn't my intention to do it, events unfolded that I think made it clear to me that someone that has healthcare experience, that has an attitude of never quit. You know, in 2014, when I lost the congressional race, my hometown newspaper, the Atomic Courier, had the editorial review board, which is what the candidate is saying to the paper. Mm-hmm. And in that, they quoted me as saying, if I lost the election, I was going to move out of the state. Well, I've never left the state I loved. I've stayed here and will continue to fight for what I think are policies, positions that are in keeping with my view of the nature of government, being smaller government, less taxation, and more freedom, that I'll continue to fight for those things. And I just don't see the Democrat Party, standing up for us. I think they've quit on us, and they quit on the American dream. And given my background, these are things that are tremendously important to me. For those reasons, I decided to run.
Okay. I want to ask you quickly about impeachment, because obviously that's the big looming national news story. The impeachment inquiry now moves to the House Judiciary Committee. What are your thoughts about what we heard from witnesses before the Intelligence Committee?
Well, you know, the concern that I had about the entire process that's gone through is that, one, is it's not been transparent, there hasn't been due process, and you really wonder if this is like Kavanaugh 2.0. And so the intelligence community changing what they consider to be a whistleblower at the time that the whistleblower complaints came forward. You know, to me, the whistleblower protection is for people that have firsthand knowledge, so that they have a life or a job is threatened if they come forward with allegations. So this whole process of allowing and changing the rules for what's considered a whistleblower within the intelligence community, to me, that was problematic. I see the way that the hearings have unfolded, or the process has unfolded, has not been transparent. And I really don't think it's been a fair process. Certainly has not been a bipartisan process going forward either. And you really wonder if, they're just trying to overturn a duly elected president. So they're trying to overturn a presidential election and a duly mm-hmm. elected president in 2016 because they didn't like the results.
Democrats would probably respond and say, hey, we're giving the White House a chance to, you know, participate in the Judiciary Committee hearings. They've refused to do so. They've not been able to, you know, they've not been unwilling to provide witnesses, such as Rudy Giuliani is kind of really at the center of all this. You know, what would your response to, you know, those objections be?
I think that there are, part of the things that the courts have suggested is that there are individuals that work with the president that have executive privilege, and that mm-hmm. we run a fine line between forcing people to testify or to present evidence or present themselves for questioning and be subpoenaed, but yet have relationships with any president, regardless of what party, that function to assist the president. And there is executive privilege. It has been called for before. But again, I'm going to go back to this hasn't been a transparent process to begin with. They didn't take a vote to have hearings. They have not allowed all the witnesses that the Republicans want to have. So I don't see the process as being a transparent, fair process to begin with. And to start the impeachment when they know that the president is going to be out of the country, that brings another question of, you know, is this being done too hastily, and what's the true motivation for this process?
Okay. I want to shift gears to foreign policy. Congress just passed the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act that mandates sanctions on Chinese and Hong Kong officials who carry out human rights abuses and requires an annual review of the favorable trade status that Washington grants Hong Kong.
even with China threatening sanctions, was this the right move? Are we doing enough, do you believe, to pressure China on their human rights abuses, like the Uyghurs and against Christians?
Yeah, certainly what's happening with the Uyghurs, the indoctrination camps, re-education camps, is a travesty. We do have freedom of religion in the United States. It is a reason why people want to immigrate here to this country. And I think that we have, as we're trying to go through trade negotiations with China, sometimes we lose sight of other aspects of the United States and things that we stand for when it comes to democracy, freedom of religion, freedom of speech. I think that this was the right move by Congress and the right move by the president to sign on to this. So we should stand for people desiring to have freedom of expression, freedom of religion, the freedom of opportunity that we have here in the United States. That doesn't mean that we're trying to make every country or that we have to police every country, but I think to stand for human rights, to stand for freedom-loving people in Hong Kong was the right move to make.
Okay. Iran is facing their worst unrest in over 40 years. What do you think the Trump administration and U.S. response should be to that, what's happening on the ground in Iran?
So part of that is what our intelligence community will happen, what just happened recently. I think that report of over 200 deaths in Iran. I know that the government of Iran is challenging that figure, but you know, this is very akin to the democracy freedom movements that were happening during the Obama administration. So for us to be aware of what's going on, continue the sanctions that we have to stop Iran from developing nuclear power, and then what we can do to support individuals. But you have to do that in a careful manner because we don't always know when we inject ourselves into to challenges within from people within their government, which side is doing what, and do we have all the true facts? So we need to continue to gather intelligence. We need to support people that are seeking to have regime change in Iran and more freedom. But at the same point in time, we need to continue the sanctions that we have in Iran and to force the Iranian government or to pressure, persuade the Iranian government to stop development of potential nuclear weapons.
Okay. President Trump is currently in London for the NATO summit. What are your thoughts on his handling of NATO and the accusations that are leveled against him that, you know, he's alienating our NATO allies?
Well, I think that it is not a new concept that people feel that the United States has long been military support for NATO, and that NATO countries have not been paying into NATO to the degree that they should. And so I think for President Trump to say, if we want to have strong alliances, we want to have support of multiple countries to be able to engage in a multi-nation process, such as what President Bush had done in Afghanistan, that those countries need to be able to pay their fair share, and that the United States alone can't carry the burden for the world. So I think from that standpoint, being vocal about it and being upfront about it, I think that type of candid speech is not something that's common. And so I think the president voiced what a lot of people in the United States feel about NATO, and that they too need to be responsible for their own defense and for upholding the values of NATO and the outcome of, you know, two civil wars that led to the development of NATO.
Okay.
Or, excuse me, not two civil wars, two world wars.
Right, right. Just one last question on foreign policy. You know, President Trump's wanting to withdraw troops from Afghanistan. But should we negotiate with the Taliban in order to withdraw from Afghanistan? I've talked with people on different sides of the issue, and they say, well, Taliban's really no better than Al-Qaeda. And then others say, well, Taliban's completely different than Al-Qaeda. They're not a terrorist organization. What are your thoughts?
I think that you have to look at the functioning government, the functioning factions there, who has authority. No one wants us to stay long-term in Afghanistan. I don't think most Americans, whether or not they agreed with President Bush and the actions that were taken in Afghanistan and Iraq, don't want to see us engaged in lengthy wars with foreign countries without some kind of exit strategy and plan and a definition of what success would be. So mm-hmm. Where we can deal with the government, the authority, the powers that are there, and in this case, maybe the Taliban, then to engage in conversation, to engage in dialogue, I don't think that that's necessarily a misstep and can be very worthwhile. So okay. I would continue to get information, knowledge. I certainly don't have all of the information, both intelligence and culturally and government-wise, that the White House and President Trump's team and Congress has at this point in time to really make mm-hmm. a firm decision to say, no, this would be completely inappropriate.
Okay. Bringing it back home, CBS News reports that over 300 ads for President Trump were removed by Google and YouTube. This follows Twitter's ban on political ads, but the allowance of issue ads that appear to be the favor left-wing issues. Social media bans and censorship appear to be fairly one-sided. Should Congress get involved?
Congress may indeed need to get involved, especially given the size, the volume. I won't say monopoly, but close monopoly on social media. This is censorship, and who makes that decision? And Facebook, Twitter, Google to be able to make a YouTube for that matter to be able to make a determination on what is appropriate, what's inappropriate. What's hate speech, what's not hate speech, what leads to terrorism. Certainly we know that there are issues and security issues that are on social media, so there needs to be some oversight and outlook. But to me, what's happening now is censorship. And I think underscores to people who feel that the media is biased and they're not getting access to all media sources and all information so that they can truly make informed decisions, that this is one more nail in that coffin, that the media is biased and we're not able to really make a determination on what's real news and if we're getting all the information to make informed choices and to know how to vote, how to interact, and how to interpret what it is that we see.
Okay. Speaker Nancy Pelosi says her goal is to pass the USMCA by Christmas, but Representative Cindy Axley admitted recently, passage has been held up because of labor union concerns. Who should have a place at the table when these trade deals are made, and what would you look for in trade deals that come up for a vote?
Well, the answer to the last question is that trade deals need to be fair, so that they need not to disadvantage the United States or the United States workers. Not to disadvantage employers within the United States. We know that we're in a global economy, so trade is important, and fair trade is important also in keeping peace around the globe. So these are important issues. I think getting input and, having been a director of public health, we mm-hmm. bring stakeholders together and get input from multiple different sources. So I think it is appropriate to get input from multiple different sources, be they from the employer standpoint or the employee standpoint, from congressional representatives, people throughout a broad spectrum of the economy with different facets that they can bring in to that conversation. But ultimately, the president is responsible for negotiating trade deals, and USMCA should have already been passed. This should not be on the table now. We should not be talking about Christmas. Every Democrat, Representative Loebsack, who's not running for re-election, should be coming out and pressuring his party and asking his party to pass USMCA. It's good for the country. It's good for our state. It's good for our economy. And it's good for the United States of America. So why hasn't it been done? And to me, this is just a political maneuver by a party who doesn't want to give any victory to the president, regardless of whether it hurts the country or not.
Okay, so I want to ask you a question about, you know, your wheelhouse and health care. Democrats are proposing Medicare for all, but Republicans have been unsuccessful in repealing or replacing Obamacare. How do we fix health care? I mean, what do you think the approach of Congress should be?
Well, it's a very complex question. I'm not sure we have enough time to go into all of it, but we need health care, medical care. So there's health and there's medical care and medical insurance. So I distinguish those things. Health is something that we, with the exception of our genetic makeup, that we can have some determination in, the kind of lifestyle that we lead, whether we smoke, whether we get the right amount of exercise, sleep, if we eat right, eating our fruit and vegetables, even brushing our teeth. So those are aspects of our health that we have control over. Then you have the other end of that spectrum, and that's medical care and receiving medical care. And it needs to be affordable, it needs to be accessible, but it needs to allow people to have choice, which Medicare for All, we know cost-wise, the Mercatus at George Mason has said $32 trillion over 10 years. Elizabeth Warren's plan came out at $52 trillion over 10 years. The cost of that is astronomical. It would decimate our military and really be a tremendous threat to our national security. It is not a workable solution. Who in the government can make decisions for you and your family on what you should receive, how you should receive it, who should have access? Do you have access to a doctor? It would be a travesty for this country to do Medicare for All, which would not be the Medicare that seniors are used to now, or that I as a doctor am used to now. We need a healthcare system that allows for the doctor-physician relationship or doctor-nurse practitioner, whoever your provider is, but that relationship is paramount. Those are the people that should be helping you to make the decision, giving you all the information. And sometimes that will be more care and sometimes that will be less care, but those are decisions that you, your provider, and your family should be making, not a government bureaucrat.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so talk to us a little bit more about the you talked about price transparency with prescription drugs. How the legislation you tried to pass in Iowa, how does that work? What does that look like?
So we did pass legislation. So
okay, I'm sorry.
After the Affordable Care Act went through, drug prices skyrocketed. So within 2 years of the passage of the Affordable Care Act, by 2012, drug prices had quadrupled. I had people bring me their receipts to show me what their cost of medication was before and what their cost of medication was 2 years later. And we've seen that, especially with insulin, where the cost of insulin less than 10 years ago was $137 a month, and now it's over $500 a month for Humalog. And there have been congressional hearings and testimony from the drug companies on this. What's changed in the past decade is that pharmacy benefit managers, or PBMs, control 70% of the marketplace. So it's a near monopoly. So 70% of prescriptions that are filled in the United States now go through a PBM, or pharmacy benefit manager. And insurance companies that provide, and this includes Medicare and Medicaid, insurance companies that provide a drug benefit have to negotiate, as do pharmaceutical companies, with the PBMs. So in order for a pharmaceutical company to get a drug on to a formulary that it would be offered through a PBM, they negotiate and have rebates with the PBM. So when you're controlling 70% of the marketplace, that gives you tremendous leverage. I'm not going to say that there have not been some benefits to the PBMs in lowering some drug costs, but by far and away, we see this middleman as increasing drug costs. And that's why there was hearings in Congress on this issue with both the drug companies and the PBMs. So what our bill was trying to do was, one, to get transparency. What's the amount of the rebates that the pharmaceutical companies have to give to the PBMs? What's the aggregate amount of those rebates? What's the aggregate amount of the administrative fees? And what's the aggregate amount of the rebates that are not passed on to the insurance companies? The insurance companies use the rebates to reduce premiums to all of their members, but that doesn't help the person who has to go pay for insulin that used to be $137 and now is $536. So it really is an issue of access and care. So the bill that we were able to get through, we didn't get the rebates passed on to the individual purchasing the drug. We'll continue to work on that. But we did get the transparency part through, which is tremendously important. And I think that's a huge key to this. So that's similar to what President Trump was doing with his executive order on pricing transparency in healthcare. It's a way to get more transparency, to get more competition, to help bring down costs. Our bill will require that the pharmacy benefit managers have to report all of this information to the insurance division by this February. So we'll have information in case we want to do more legislation this upcoming session.
Okay. All right. In this cycle and in previous cycles, you've been criticized by some as not being sufficiently pro-life. How would you respond to that, and what kinds of pro-life legislation would you support if elected to Congress?
Well, I think my record on this has been very clear. I've been vetted numerous times. I've been endorsed by Susan B. Anthony. I've been endorsed by Maggie's List. I'm pro-life. I'm Catholic. Just my personal life, my children did Teen Leaders in Action and preventing pregnancy when they were in high school. I was a co-sponsor and voted for our bill this last legislative session that in response to the heartbeat bill being struck down that said that the Iowa Constitution does not guarantee a right or protected right to abortion.
Life amendment.
So that life amendment supported that. We defunded Planned Parenthood in our human services bill, and life the heartbeat bill that had exceptions for rape, incest, and the physical life of the mother. I am in support of exceptions for rape, incest, and life of the mother. But I think we, in our desire to have abortion ended, we need to continue to look at preventing pregnancy, educating, helping young women. I've contributed to organizations like the Covenant House that helps pregnant women, pregnant teenagers, and talk about adoption and how we can help women to, number one, avoid pregnancy, reduce promiscuity, and allow them to know that there is hope for them, that there is a lifestyle with education, with training that can improve their circumstances. So those things that lead to unwanted pregnancies, we need to do as much as we can to help young women and young men to know that this is a tremendous responsibility. And that, you know, we don't want abortion, but we're also there to help them to navigate through very difficult circumstances in their life.
Great. Thank you. Do you believe that sexual orientation and gender identity should be added to the federal civil rights laws as protected classes? Yes, because the House, give you a little context, the House just passed the Equality Act, which does that. Senate right now, it's probably dead on arrival in the Senate, but I'm sure this is going to be brought up again and again if the Democrats are in the majority. So what are your thoughts on that? And as a follow-up, what could be done to protect religious liberty in light of competing liberty interests between people of faith and the LGBTQ community?
Well, I certainly strongly believe that that we need to protect religious liberty. It's one of the tenets and foundation of the United States of America, constitutionally protected. And I see erosion in religious liberty and attacks on people of faith. And that is tremendously concerning. It's also concerning to me when I see, as a woman, when I see biological males competing in female sports and winning in female sports and allowed to compete. And so that brings up the question, have we gone too far in support of people making different choices when it really is disadvantaging an entire another group of people? So mm-hmm. I have a lot of concerns about that. I probably would be, like the Senate, I would be dead on arrival. But I don't know exactly what the bill entailed, what was in the bill. And I always feel that you need to read bills, you need to understand them, you need to talk to different individuals, both on both sides of an issue or all sides of an issue to be able to make any decision and determination. And so I hesitate to say I would absolutely not support something without right. having first been able to read it and interact with individuals. Reading, and I think that we
reading bills, what a novel concept.
I know. It's like a balanced budget. We have a balanced budget amendment in the state of Iowa, but yet our country can, you know, go into debt and issue bonds and seemingly not care about the fact that our national debt's escalating.
Well, that's a great that provides a great segue for a question I kind of skipped over because I didn't think I was going to have time. No one's talking about deficit spending and our national debt, at least not you know, looking at all the presidential candidates, unfortunately even President Trump. What do you believe could be done to address it?
Well, I have long supported a balanced budget amendment at the federal level. I see, having been through one session, I see how it works in our state. It's a great process, and it gives us a guideline. And at the federal government, you know, if you don't get an automatic 2% increase, that's called a cut. Well, that's not a cut in spending if you just don't get an increase. And you're correct. Neither party at this time, none of the Democrat presidential candidates and our current president are talking about the national debt. This is a huge issue. We know that if we grow our economy, and so decreasing regulation, as President Trump has done, has been tremendous. Looking at economic growth, the tax reform, both within our state and at the federal government, has helped to grow our economy. So one way to reduce the national debt is to grow the economy and increase the amount of revenue that comes into the federal government. But we also need to look at all of our programs at waste and fraud. And I think Rand Paul just came out with a Twitter comment about $500,000 on a special type of toilet. And those may be small figures when you're talking about a $1 trillion budget, but they're huge figures when they all add up.
Right.
So I think it is incumbent upon us to look at the federal budget, look at how we spend money, grow the economy so we get more revenue. But we have to be very cautious, and I would be in support of a balanced budget amendment at the federal level, just like we have here in our state.
All right. We want to get a question in for any libertarian listeners that I might have. What are your thoughts on legalizing marijuana?
Well, I was one of the senators that supported the bill that came up last session in expanding the medical marijuana. I do think that we need to work. It's sort of like putting the cart before the horse, if I can say that. I was asked this question 10 years ago at the University of Iowa, and we need to have the federal government change the DEA classification so we can actually do research on marijuana. Much of the data we have now comes from Israel or from Europe, and it's not bad data. It's good medical data, but we need to be able to do research. We need to have data and information, and we also need to be able to detect impaired drivers. We can do that for alcohol, but we can't do that for marijuana. There may be some scientific research that's going on now that may allow us to detect impaired drivers, but it seems to me we need to have those things in place before we go for full legalization of recreational marijuana.
Okay. Just last question. Just want you to just kind of give our listeners your final pitch, why they should vote for you if they're a voter in Iowa's 2nd Congressional District.
Because I never quit. I never give up. I've never stopped believing in the American dream and the opportunities that were afforded to us and the constitutional rights that we have as United States citizens. Those things are so important that I'm willing to sacrifice my medical career, run for office again, because it's important that we be able to have religious freedom, that we have the ability to have free speech, the freedom to associate, our Second Amendment rights. These things at this point in time are at risk. A free market capitalism, which has helped end poverty throughout the world. If your concern is climate change and global warming, always remember that countries, as they've increased their wealth, have also improved their environment and made cleaner environment. I remember growing up with acid rain, overpopulation, and that the earth was going to die at that time. I don't believe that the earth is going to die in 12 years. But if we allow our economy to grow through free market capitalistic principles, we'll be able to address all issues as well as tackling poverty and allowing people to reach their God-given potential. I'm a fighter. I never quit. I'm working for Iowan. I have never given up on the state that I love, and I've never given up on the fact that D.C. politicians do not know more than Iowans. We should be able to control our destiny and have the future of the American dream.
Where can people learn more about your campaign?
They can visit our website at MillerMeeks2020.com. They can certainly contact me through Facebook or Twitter as well.
And that concludes today's episode of the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you happen to be listening to this podcast somewhere other than on our website, please be sure to check out CaffeinatedThoughts.com. That's CaffeinatedThoughts.com. Or just Google Caffeinated Thoughts, CaffeinatedThoughts, Thoughts, and it'll show up at the top of your search screen. Also, be sure to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for our emails, so that way you don't miss a single update. If you happen to be listening to this on Apple Podcasts, please give us a 5-star rating. We would appreciate it. The higher ratings we get, the easier it makes for people, you know, it makes for people to find our podcast when they search. Also, you can listen to this podcast not only on Apple Podcasts, but also on Google Play Music, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Podbean. If there's a podcast app that we're not on that you would like to see us get on, please drop me a line at shane@caffeinatedthoughts.com, and I'll try to see if I can make that happen. So I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Have a great week, everybody. This is Shane Vanderhart signing off. Take care.